Some of you may know that I stuttered pretty good for the first 25 years of my life. I would go to bed at night praying that I would wake up fluent, to be able to say my own name or answer in class or even make a speech. But I awoke each day only to discover that my stuttering was still a reality. When I was 14, a famous speech doctor in Michigan told me and my parents that I would always stutter. He said stuttering was something that was from the womb to the tomb. He advised me to develop a thick skin so I wouldn't care when people teased me. I never got that tough, and I still care. When I was 19, I got my draft notice, but after the examination, I was classified 4F, that is, unable to serve in the Army because of my stuttering. It took me a minute. A minute's a long time. It took me a minute to say, "I do," when I got married. I've been turned down for jobs because of my stuttering. While working on a master's degree in speech-language pathology, I was assigned two adult fluency clients. After our first session, they got together and went to the clinic director behind my back and complained that my stuttering was worse than theirs. They wanted a fluent clinician. I was called in and told to speak to a new faculty member there who was specializing in stuttering disorders. An interesting thing happened during our first conversation. He was the first speech pathologist who listened when I told him of my dream to someday speak fluently. He was the first speech pathologist who did not set a limit on how fluent I might eventually become. Instead, he said something like this: "I don't know how fluent you might eventually become, David, but why don't we work together and see?" He had a plan, he was sensitive, he was confident, but most importantly, I trusted him. I tell you this personal story to make what I believe to be an exceedingly important point. This person, Dr. Eugene Cooper, whom I met at Ohio University, was the first person, the first speech pathologist of many, who did not insist that I give up my dream of someday speaking fluently. He made no promises. He gave no guarantees. He agreed to be my therapist, that is, my guide in a crisis. I now believe that he is one of the reasons for my success. So I would suggest that you do not insist that your clients give up their dreams. We do not know enough yet about the human condition or what makes other people motivated to say that they won't eventually be fluent. One of my favorite quotes is by the German poet Goethe, who wrote, "If you dream, you can begin it. Boldness has power, genius, and magic in it." This experience with Dr. Cooper and several authors' thinking, after reading several authors' work, enabled me to change my paradigm, that is, my model of treatment. Stephen Covey, who's the author of The 7 Secrets of Highly Effective People, wrote, quote, "If you want to make small incremental improvements, work on behavior. But if you want to make quantum leaps in improvement, work on paradigms." I only really started making noticeable progress after about the age of 24, 25, when I gave up my illusion of becoming perfectly fluent. I remember when Dr. Cooper said, "Well, David, what would you like your speech to be like?" And I said, "William Jennings Bryant." He was the golden-tongued orator. And as long as I kept that, I failed to make any significant progress. And I found another quote that I like. This is by Ludwig Born, who wrote, "Losing an illusion makes you wiser than finding a truth." Dr. Cooper helped me modify my perceptions of my stuttering, and together we taught me a new paradigm, a new way of viewing my problem. In effect, I changed my belief. I believe that clinicians should help fluency clients change their belief. Hiram Smith, who's the author of The 10 Natural Laws of Time and Life Management, proposed a belief window that would screen all incoming and outgoing messages. Smith argued that what we believe determines the outcome. Incorrect beliefs will produce negative self-defeating behaviors. Negative behaviors will defeat our best attempts to take control of our life. Now, I'm going to try to go to the overhead to show a few pictures. Thank you. Can you hear me in the back? Thank you. All right. Now, I read Hiram Smith's book, and I was impressed with it, so I drew this representation of what I think he was talking about, and that is, everywhere we turn, our belief window goes with us. And we screen all incoming messages, and we screen all outgoing messages. Some of the beliefs that we might have are European cars are superior to American cars. If you believe that, what kind of a car are you going to buy? Women are smarter managers than men. My political affiliation is better than your political affiliation. Once a stutter, always a stutter. Ideas formed early, or ideas taught by parents or respected people of authority, have a profound influence on us. Such beliefs are deeply ingrained. Adolescents challenge their parents' beliefs. I think adults should periodically examine their own beliefs too. Remember Benjamin Franklin? I like one of his quotes. He said, "The eyes of other people are the eyes that ruin us." When an individual stutters, we feel the little explosions or laryngeal catches or changes in breathing or whatever occurs. We feel that. And we have a moment of stuttering. And then there's the listener's reaction to our moment of stuttering. And then there's our reaction to the listener's reaction, plus our own internal reactions. Well, on your handout, I have my seven beliefs of things that I think that we should think about. These are my beliefs. You don't have to adopt them, but I know you have beliefs of your own. I was watching the Today Show a year or two ago, and this Andrew Weil came on and said the belief of the practitioner is more important than the belief of the patient. Well, I'm not sure that's true, but I believe, on my belief window, is a statement that the belief of the clinician is as important as the belief of the client. All right, let's go. I'm going to go through four of my seven beliefs. I'm going to go through number one, number four, number one, two, four, and seven. Number one, improvement is possible for every person who stutters. Not normal or near normal fluency per se, but substantial improvement in fluency skills. Number two, the clinician is a more critical variable affecting a client's success than any specific technique or treatment program. The client-clinician relationship is the foundation of future personal growth and the enhancement of fluency skills. I'm going to skip to number four. The clinician's belief about possible treatment outcome are as important as the client's beliefs, and the client's insecurity and doubts are significantly affected by the clinician's insecurity and doubts. The first four speech pathologists that I saw, two men and two women, exuded insecurity. One guy taught me to talk like a ventriloquist as much as he could. I don't know if he believed in it. Another person had me chew all my words. And I was paying money. I was mowing lawns to go in and, you know, get this therapy kind of thing. And I guess I just believed that they weren't too sure about what they were doing. So, number seven, most successful fluency individuals are still recovering. Some have actually recovered and no longer stutter or fear speaking. Speech-language pathologists should not deny such individuals the reality of their experiences. I think we need to study such people. I have four people on the tip of my tongue who are more disfluent than most of us on the panel. They do not perceive themselves to be stutters. They have no fear about speaking. They just talk. They have the same laryngeal catch as I do. All right? But they just never thought of themselves as people with a stuttering problem. They're all very, very successful. One's my dean. Another one's in central administration at the university. And I have lunch with a gentleman, who I've had lunch with for about 15 years, who stuttered very severely till the age of 22, got out of the Army, still stuttering, went and saw a speech pathologist, does not stutter anymore, has no fear of speaking. I know we learn a lot from our failures. I think maybe we should try to learn something from these people that have had some success. How are we doing on time?
About 4 minutes.
4 minutes, perfect. So a question that I occasionally ask myself is, am I a recovered stutter or am I a recovering stutter? Do I fear stuttering? No. Do I think about my stuttering very much? No. I don't think about my stuttering any more than I think about my crabgrass. And I don't think I haven't thought about crabgrass in 3 or 4 years. Do I have days in which I am more disfluent than other days? Yes. Does everyone else? Yes. So, do I consider myself to be a stutterer? Yes. No. And I'm not sure. But I think we need to look at the whole spectrum of fluency disorders from our friends, colleagues, clients, who have significant fluency problems and have worked on them as hard as anyone else could, ever, and they're making progress. But I think we should go all the way to the other end of the continuum and maybe learn from some of these people. I think there are hundreds, maybe thousands of those people out there. And I think they are worthy of our research project. So Steve Covey said, we all think that we see things and we're objective, but we see the world not as it is, but as we are, or as we have been conditioned to see it. And he adds, the way that we see the problem is the problem. And then I ask this question. That's called a hardening of the mind. What you were taught years and years and years ago still sticks. And maybe you need to evaluate your belief window system. And I found this the other day. I thought it was rather cute. So do you believe in yourself, huh? Norman Cousins in The Biology of Hope says your belief affects your biology. And I think I've got one more. Well, I'm going to read this last little bit and then I'll show you my last one. So the question I'm asking is, do we believe in ourselves? My new belief window prompted me to wonder, what if, now I know this is impossible, but what if it were possible for some stuttering clients to get normal or near normal fluency? What if, now I know this is impossible, but what if a substantial number of such former stutters that were so fluent that no one knew that they stuttered, except their speech-language pathologist who had such long ears that we caught them? There's one. What about the other 9,000 words this person said fluently? I know it's impossible, but what if? We have heard for years that we learn much more from our failures than from our successes. I think it's time we learn from our successes. What if a substantial number of such former clients agreed to participate in thorough, in-depth medical and psychological studies? The Orton Society is asking those of us who stutter to donate our brains. They are. We all know that such ideas are impossible, right? Right. But what if it wasn't? Thank you.